Welcome back to the program. Often it seems as if there's a hopelessness with respect to personal progress, that it is our ultimate destiny not to go ever forward, but to be pushed back or stuck in our past. Perhaps no one understood this or put it better than Fitzgerald in the last line of Gatsby when he said, "So we beat on, boats against the current, borne back ceaselessly into the past." It would seem that this destiny is almost part of our DNA, if not as a species, then at least as Americans. But does it have to be so? My guest, investigative journalist Bob Sullivan, thinks not. He thinks we can overcome what he calls the plateau effect. Bob Sullivan is an investigative journalist and best-selling author of Gotcha Capitalism and Stop Getting Ripped Off. It is my pleasure to welcome him here today to talk about the plateau effect. Thanks so much for joining us.
Oh, thanks so much for having me. I appreciate it.
Great to have you here. First of all, explain a little bit about what the plateau effect is all about.
The plateau effect is something that's familiar to everybody who's ever tried to lose weight or body build and some other ventures of life, too. It very simply means that something that you do works really well at the beginning and then starts to top out, and suddenly you're working more and more and getting less and less results. Sometimes we call it beginner's luck followed by sophomore slump, but it's a phenomenon that has occurred since the beginning of humanity. It's even before that, because it's built into physics, it's built into biology, and it leads us into these spots of frustration and desolation. But as we argue in the book, when you start to understand what's going on, the first thing is you feel better about being stuck, and the second thing is there's some things you can do to get yourself back to that exciting beginning feeling and get away from that middle stuck feeling.
Given that life and virtually everything moves so much faster today, are we getting to that plateau point in almost everything we do at greater and greater speeds?
Yes, and that's why we wrote the book now. I have been covering technology and the negative side of technology for about 20 years, and Dr. Hugh Thompson, my co-author, is a mathematician who actually is a computer security expert. So we've observed this, and I'm a bit of a just a natural skeptic of technology and modern life and gadgets and all those things. In fact, I was accused of being a big data hater the other day on TV, which I was proud of. I'm not a data hater. I actually like a lot about technology. But all of this thing, so our technology really is working against us, and it's forcing us into these plateaus and getting us stuck quicker and quicker, unnaturally so. And that's why this is an important topic today, because plateaus can be a good thing. Plateaus, again, people, I have plenty of friends, young married couples, who just finally can afford to move into their own house, and they're very happy to suddenly have a stable life, and that's fine. But the problem is, right now, the natural forces, which are supposed to work in harmony with our cycles, are being abused by modern life, by speed, by technology, by distractions, and we're finding ourselves more and more frustrated. And I don't know anyone who doesn't feel like they're working harder and harder for less and less. And so that's why we did the book now.
And talk about this notion that we are programmed biologically in many respects to always want the new thing. I mean, now it may be in the form of technology, and in previous times it may have been something entirely different, but we always want what's new, what's different, what we haven't experienced before.
Our brains are wired to notice new things. Our brains are wired to notice potential threats. This is an evolutionary trait that dates back to when we were surrounded by natural predators and we were trying to fight them off. Your nose is a really good example of this, and we'll talk about acclimation in a moment, but think about when you were on the African savanna maybe 5,000 years ago. Your brain didn't stop to smell the roses, and you didn't smell the people around you because they were familiar. But if a natural enemy, an animal, were to walk somewhere nearby, your nose would wake up immediately, because that's a distraction, and it's an important distraction because that distraction could kill you. That is literally how your brains work. The problem is, let's say it was a lion. The problem is right now, The lion that could kill you is turned into a million emails and text messages and phone calls that you get every day now. All of those things capture your attention and light up your brain the way that a threat would have lit it up 5,000 years ago. And so we are now constantly distracted the way that someone who was being threatened by 1,000 mountain lions would have been distracted 5 years ago.
And in many ways, we don't see it coming. We don't realize it's happening. It feels a little bit like the frog that you put into the water and then little by little turn up the heat.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, all of this has occurred very, very slowly. Under what we call in the book the just noticeable difference, there's this thing that the psychophysiologists talk about, which is there's a level at which something grows or dies or moves, And it happens below the conscious level. It's something called the just noticeable difference. And when things are occurring at that level in our lives, of course, we don't pay attention and we can suddenly be that frog that's dead in the boiled pot of water. But on the other hand, it's happened very quickly. As a consumer advocate writer, as someone who writes about technology and worries about it, I, of course, also have thought a lot about labor and the differences in the labor world today versus even 50 or 25 years ago. And what I say is this labor union spent 150 years getting us nights and weekends off, and smartphones took them away in about 2.5 years. It's incredible. I call it, it's a computer virus on modern life. I don't have 10 friends. If I pick 10 friends, 9 of them would tell me they write work emails now on Saturday nights.
Of course.
Because you can't be the one who doesn't, not in this economy, right? And so as a result, we're tethered to work all the time. It's something that psychologist Linda Stone has called continuous partial attention. So there's always, it's almost like an umbilical cord to your brain that's pulling you back to the office or pulling you to something else. So you're never really quite with the people that you're with. If you're trying to learn how to play guitar, you're never really playing guitar because you can't get immersed in it. And that element of modern life is incredibly distracting. And, of course, it drives you towards this numbness, which is at the core of almost every plateau, that slowly but surely everything that you do you become numb to because it becomes too same. And if you're not paying attention to it, we all become numb.
It's interesting because there are certain parts of that that create the numbness that you're talking about. But what the technology also does when that phone vibrates in your pocket, regardless of whether you're at the symphony or whether you're at work, it gives you that quick jolt of adrenaline that you may have something to look at, something to look forward to.
Yeah, there's been numerous studies that equate the jolt that you get, the kick you get out of a text message to the kick that you get out of drugs. So there absolutely is there's a dopamine rush that occurs as a result of these technologies. And so they absolutely are addictive, and they're not addictive as a metaphor. They are as addictive as if they were a drug.
One of the things you talk about in the book is that there are different types of plateaus. I think you identify 8 of them specifically. Talk a little bit about the difference with respect to these plateaus.
Sure. There's plenty of reasons that people get stuck in these different places, and when you identify them, they're a lot easier to overcome. So numbness or acclimation is the first one, and we've given some pretty good examples of that. Another one that we like to talk a lot about is the greedy algorithm. Dr. Thompson is a mathematician, and so there's a lot of, we try not to say this at least early in the conversations about the book, but there's a lot of higher mathematics in the book where we prove that plateaus exist in the first thing that you learn about in calculus. They don't call it a plateau, but they teach you about logarithms. Logarithms are plateaus. But I'm going to get off the math now, lest I scare anyone too much. But the greedy algorithm is borrowed from mathematics. And what it says is that any computer, any algorithm, any person that's searching for solutions will pick the locally optimal solution over the globally optimal solution all the time. In English, the short-term gain over the long-term gain. And we see that on Wall Street all the time. Companies can't help but do whatever they can to maximize profits in this 90-day window so that their quarterly results are better. And as a result, they're not thinking about the long-term health of the company. And that's why so many companies now are actually delisting from Wall Street and going private so that they can get out of this crazy, greedy algorithm cycle of worrying about every quarter.
But is that just about Wall Street? Let me interrupt you for a second.
No.
Is that just about Wall Street, or is that a broader aspect of human nature? I mean, you talk about, many people on this program have talked about, the famous marshmallow experiments. It is, in many ways, it's something that's pre-programmed into us.
It can be, although the marshmallow experiment and some other similar experiments that I've seen with behavioral economists and money, you can actually change people's outcome from the marshmallow experiment. And for your listeners who aren't familiar with that, Stanford University did this classic experiment 70 years ago, and it's still being done today, where they put a little kid in a room, they put a marshmallow next to the kid, and they say, "I'll come back in 10 minutes. If you don't eat the marshmallow, I'll give you a second one." And then they leave the room, and the poor kid has to figure out how to get through the 10 minutes without eating the marshmallow. And some of them do, some of them don't. And the ones that succeed at the test, that hold off on eating the marshmallow, it's an incredible predictor to success later in life, to their grades in elementary school, to the high school they go to what their SAT scores are. And, in fact, the amount of time the kid can hold out has almost a direct correlation to what their SAT scores are. So there's this suggestion that we're pre-wired and either you have self-discipline or you don't, or you can delay gratification or you can't. But once they've worked with kids who make the wrong choice the first time and they give some techniques to work around those things. And it's exciting when you see someone who actually learns not to eat the marshmallow later in life, because again, there's ways to do that. But eating the marshmallow, taking the first marshmallow instead of waiting for the second one, is a metaphor for so many things that we do when it comes to money, when it comes to eating, when it comes to a business success. And that's a topic that I love talking about, because it is something that people can change, and that's something that we really discuss a lot in the book, is how do you get around the greedy algorithm.
Mm-hmm. Talk about the difference, the fundamental difference between plateaus and ceilings, because in many ways, in many circumstances, they feel like they might be the same thing.
Sure, and that's incredibly important to realize when you have reached the limits of your of whatever it is that you're doing, and it's time for you to fail fast instead of to keep hanging on. We talk about failing fast in the book. Let me tell you a quick story that will illustrate this concept. Hugh is from the Bahamas, and like in a lot of places, but in the Bahamas it's a much bigger deal. They have this big Easter egg hunt in the village where he grew up, and all the kids go running onto this field where there's Easter eggs planted. And as every economic student who's ever taken a class will tell you, most of the eggs are discovered in the first 5 minutes when they're plentiful. Very, very quickly, they become a scarce resource. The resources diminish, and then all the kids have to spend an hour or two finding the last couple of eggs. Now, a lot of our lives are like that. So when you have a diminishing resource that cannot be replenished, that's when you hit a ceiling. So at a certain point, you stop hunting for the Easter eggs, right? Now let's change the Easter egg experiment a little bit, and let's say every hour parents go in and they reseed Easter eggs in that patch. Well, now you've got a whole different equation, right? Now you have a replenishing resource based on an important time element. And so if you're a smart kid, not only should you keep looking all day because there's going to be new Easter eggs, but also if you observe and you respect the power of time, and there's a whole big section in the book on the importance of your respecting the power of time, the best thing for you to do is to only search for 5 minutes every hour, right? The first 5 minutes that the new eggs are laid. And that's a really powerful concept in the book, is when can you most effectively use your time. If I were to graph the success rate of a kid hunting for an egg, even in this replenishing universe, it would continually plateau. It would top out constantly, and the effort they have to spend to get an egg would continually be the same thing. Now, if there's one kid in that room who figures out this magic formula of, I'm going to work for 5 minutes and then rest for 55 minutes and keep coming back at the right time, he's going to soar, and his results are going to be 25 times better. We did the math, 25 times better than the other kids. So that's the kind of timing that you're looking for in life, and that's how you bust through a plateau, by cracking those kinds of codes.
And the other analogy that you use, which is an interesting one, is the musical analogy, that the silence is just as important as the notes.
Yeah, that's right. That's Claude Debussy's famous phrase, although no one really seems to know. There's a plateau as to the research that's gone into finding out whether he really said that or not. But it's such a beautiful concept that one of the things I am a musician, and one of the things that you learn right away, especially if you play rock music, is that silence is often very hard to find in music, but yet it's a powerful tool, and it's just as important as the notes itself. So that has to do with a sense of rhythm and a sense of letting things happen naturally. And again, if you think about modern life, our ability to have rhythms, our ability to stop and take lunch and replenish our brains so that we're more effective, again, your workday is a lot like that Easter egg hunt. If you run around looking for eggs all day, you're not going to be successful. You need cycles. You need to take breaks. You need to take coffee breaks. You need to take lunch breaks. You'll never find anyone who hates tobacco more than me, but I wish we had a world where smoke breaks without the smoke were part of everyday life, because it was a really healthy thing, outside of the tobacco, to walk outside and chat with your coworkers every 90 minutes or so and replenish. Those kinds of things that we've just lost in our society, and it's very, very problematic. And the mission that I try to carry, this little windmill that I'm tilting at when I talk to companies, is don't do that to your workers. You actually aren't getting more productivity out of them. Their productivity has plateaued. Your company's productivity has plateaued. If you make them work that much, if you don't give them breaks, if you make them email on Saturdays, it's actually, not only is it dehumanizing, but it's not effective as a company. And you're going to be more effective if you teach them how to search for the eggs when the eggs are really there.
One of the things that makes this all the more complex is that not only is this true with respect to individuals in terms of hitting those plateaus, but it also gets into the culture of companies, and as you talk about in the book, maybe it's true for the country as a whole, that we're dealing with different levels of plateaus from both the individual level right on up through corporate cultures and through the country itself.
I really think that that's true. One of the core principles of the plateau effect is that everything works until it doesn't work. Everything that you ever do, and this is the seductive nature of plateaus, you might do something very, very effective as a company, as a political party. You might cut taxes. Cutting taxes will work, and it does work. That's great. Well, what am I going to do? I'm going to cut taxes again, and maybe it works again. That's great. Well, obviously, there's a point at which it doesn't work anymore. But the way our brains work and the way our habits are is if it worked for you in the past, it's going to work for you in the future. And the world is full of people who say, you know, torpedoes be damned, I'm going to do this again because I know it worked for me in the past. And the one thing I can promise you, if you learn nothing else from this book and from this discussion, anyone who's listening, is that whatever you've done in the past that has worked, it's going to stop working. That's human nature. So you have to do, you have to induce diversity in your life somehow. Often it means doing precisely the opposite thing of what it is that you were doing. But whatever it is, it's going to stop working. And right now in America, these two political parties have pretty black and white views of things, and that's the way that our political discussion has grown. And as a result, both of them are right. Both of them have been right in the past 30 years, and both of them are convinced that whenever they were right, they're right forever. And that's just a failed system. It's impossible to work, and that's one of the reasons I think people are so frustrated that, you know, I don't mean to put words in the mouth of either political party, because I'm a reporter, and so I dislike all political parties. I find them all. I mean, I'm kidding, but I dislike politics in general, because the system of just arguing your case over and over again, it just doesn't work. Because eventually, even if you're completely right today, you're going to be completely right tomorrow, and you're going to have to adjust. And we don't have a system that allows for those adjustments.
And circumstances change. I mean, the best example of this, and we've heard the phrase, our listeners, I'm sure, have heard the phrase over and over, with respect to military operations, where we're constantly fighting the next war with the things that we learned from the last one, and that just doesn't always work.
Yeah, that's absolutely true. We're constantly protecting ourselves from the last terrorist attack, right? That's why, you know, we've spent a couple of years taking our shoes off at the airport, because that's the last way that someone tried to attack us. There's a great metaphor in the book, and it comes from the world of technology. There's this new way of building software that's called Agile, which is a revolution in the world of software. I'll explain what it is in a moment, but the fellow who invented it talks a lot about driving a car. And when he was a 10-year-old, his mom actually let him, I think he was actually in the desert in Eastern California, and in Death Valley somewhere, and his mom let him take the wheel. And what his mom taught him was that driving a car is not a set-and-forget situation. You don't just hold the wheel. You are constantly making tiny little course corrections. All of us do it very unconsciously now. But the road isn't exactly straight, even in a desert. The car doesn't drive exactly straight infinitely. And so you have to just make these tiny little adjustments. And if you try to live a set-and-forget world, well, you're going to fail miserably. So now in software, this is how it relates to software, and in many company situations, the way that software has been built for years is stakeholders sit around a table and they say, you know, it would be great if we had a new version of Windows where you could touch the laptop screen and it would do stuff. So they invent Windows 8, and they come up with a list of things that the software needs, and they come up with a schedule of when that will be built, and they make a blueprint like you might make to build a skyscraper, and they build a foundation, they start going up, and it takes 2.5 years to build a building, but in the world of technology, 2.5 years later, people are using iPhones, and you've lost the market opportunity. It's completely inadequate way. It's called a waterfall design. One thing follows another in software. It doesn't work in the world of tech, and it doesn't work in a lot of worlds. Agile, and it is what the name suggests, involves constant course corrections. It's as if you were changing the blueprint of that skyscraper with every floor that you built the building. They do software sprints. They spend 2 weeks in intense coding. They have tight deadlines. They all come together, and they have another meeting where they reinvent the software target again and again. And they have small goals, but they make them. Now, that's a really good metaphor for what it's like to survive in any business and in a lot of other situations. Think about how many times you've made plans and decided you needed to stick to them no matter what. and that led you, you know, it's like following the GPS off the bridge that doesn't exist anymore because the GPS maps are old.
Right.
That's the way a lot of us live our lives. But agile and this constant course correction is a really good metaphor for another way of getting out of those plateaus.
Of course, this goes to the heart of another aspect of human nature, and that is the basic resistance to change, which runs headlong into everything else we've been talking about.
Yeah, that's absolutely true, and it's a basic resistance to change that's so fundamental that, you know, what we know now from these functional MRI tests for our brains, that we create these neural pathways that get almost figuratively cemented in place, and other ones die off, like highways that are neglected, because we do the same things over and over again. And so it's not just a saying that people get stubborn as they get older. Our brains physically get stubborn as they get older, unless we introduce diversity into the equation. And the most dramatic example we see of that, there's tons of studies now that show that things like Alzheimer's can be staved off if you learn a language later in life. People who do these mental acuity exercises, something, but dramatic ones, like learning a language is a kind of experience, and probably most people have had, you know, if you go to a place where you don't speak the language, or maybe you speak a little of the language, and you just feel flooded. You're overwhelmed. Your senses are, you know, it's almost like you've been dropped into a pool and you can't swim. That's how it feels. But that is a time of intense learning, and it is actually like being thrown into a cold pool and everything wakes up. That's exactly the kind of mental exercise, and that's a really good metaphor for so much of the solution to the plateau effect is, how can you go jump into a cold pool and wake things up so that you don't risk things atrophying and you don't resist change? That's the real challenge.
Because both things imply that we instinctively go for the comfort zone, doing things over and over again the same way, finding that plateau and settling in again, because that comfort zone is where people tend to want to stay.
Yeah, and it's easy. But on the other hand, the most exciting thing for me about the plateau effect is, you know, most people don't want to do average work. They don't want to have a so-so marriage. They don't want to have a dog that's not really well-trained and he's kind of okay. You know, most people want to succeed. There's very few people who are actually content to be overweight and ugly and disappointed at work and disappointing their relatives and family members and bosses. But one of the most difficult parts about change is it almost always begins in a negative way. It begins with someone saying, "Honey, we have a problem in our marriage. You are a problem at work, and we need to put you on an improvement plan." And we have found over and over again, if you go to someone and you say to them, instead of, "All right, what's the problem at work?" If you say to someone, "What is your plateau? Where have you plateaued in your career?" Wow, the conversation takes off in an entirely different way. It's framed more positively. There's action-oriented discussion that you have. When you ask someone what their problem is, it becomes a bitch session. It becomes an argument. And so the plateau effect is just a new and much more positive way to talk about what is really the issue for most people. It's not that they hate their job and they're content to be miserable. It's that they feel like they've been working harder and harder and getting less and less. They've put so much into this marriage and it's not giving them what they want anymore. They've given their boss so many hours on Saturday night and they're not getting what they want anymore. That's the plateau. It doesn't mean things are broken. It means you've hit this natural phenomenon and here's some ways to get out of it.
To what extent does a limitation become the ability, or the inability, I should say, in many cases, for people to see the future, to see what things can be like beyond that plateau?
You know, I'm really glad you brought that up, because we talked about the marshmallow experiment already, but there's a new experiment going on in the world of economics and behavioral finance, which touches on exactly that model. Here's the latest science around what we now know of as the marshmallow experiment. When they put people into a chair and they ask them questions like this, and with a headset on where they can do those fMRI tests, they might say to someone, "Well, I'm going to give you either $10 today or $20 2 weeks from now. Which would you rather have?" Now, economically speaking, waiting for the $20 is the better idea, but an overwhelming number of people take the money and run. And so that shows that there's some kind of the economic term is discounting. They're very bad at imagining money in the future, that money and time have this relationship, which is complicated for people. But what they have found out is that certain parts of the brain light up in people who take the $20, other parts of the brain light up in people who take the $10 today, the people who take the money and run. The difference is this. People who are good at taking the money in the future are much better at imagining the future. There are people who can imagine a brand new car. They can imagine the smell of how exciting it's going to be when they're at the dealership. People who couldn't imagine moving into a home in a couple of years. They actually can viscerally feel what it's like when they can finally put up curtains on their own place. Those people are far better at saving than people who don't have that kind of imagination. So if you can't put yourself in that mental space of, wow, this is great, I have a new car, you'll probably just spend the money because you can't picture it, the benefits of saving it anyway. And they have found that that phenomenon, whether you have a good imagination for the future, carries over into all sorts of health effects, like diet. If you can imagine what it'll be like to wear a bathing suit in the summer and look great on the beach, you're better at dieting in January than you are if you don't have that sense of imagination. And it turns out we can actually teach people and coach people into having a better imagination. And that, to me, is really, really exciting to think about. We may actually have an incredible clue, an incredible roadmap to how to make people better at thinking about the future and working for the future.
Bob Sullivan, the book is The Plateau Effect, Getting from Stuck to Success. Bob, I thank you so much for spending time with us today.
Oh, you bet, and good luck to your listeners and with their plateaus.
Thank you. We'll take a break. I'll be right back.